This week we study Proverbs chapter 30, the wisdom of Agur. Agur was a wise man who gave us some peculiar words. He left us a brief statement on the relationship between God and man, and then a series of epigrams, short poetic sayings, interspersed with tidbits of wise advice. In this chapter, Agur leaps around from topic to topic, and in several instances his intent is less than perfectly clear. So get ready for an interesting grab bag of odds and ends. Your passage is Proverbs 30, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and read it now. In today's chapter, we have the words of Agur. Who is Agur? Good question. Some say, with no support, that this is an alternate name for Solomon. More likely, this is just an otherwise unknown person who said something that people considered wise, such that it was appended to Solomon's collection of wise sayings. From perusing some commentaries, it seems that most people think Agur was a non-Israelite, but I don't see any real support for that either. All we know about him is that he was the son of Jacob, and that he said what is written here. Who is Jacob? Another good question. Neither the name of Jacob nor Agur ever appears elsewhere in Scripture. In fact, what Agur said is even up for debate. This chapter tells us where Agur started talking, but it does not clearly say where he ended. My presumption is that the entire chapter is Agur's work, but the passage can pretty clearly be divided up into different sections. I have read suggestions that no more than the first six verses belong to Agur and the rest belong to some other unnamed author. I doubt that, though. It seems to me that since we have Agur's name on chapter 30 and then Lemuel's name on chapter 31, that probably all of chapter 30 is Agur's, or else we would have named the other author. In verses 1 through 9, we have Agur's poetic discourse with God. This takes up almost a third of the chapter and is the longest thing that he had to say. In the first three verses, he states the fallen condition of man. Man, he says, has not learned wisdom, which he poetically equates with knowledge of the Holy One. We have discussed several times that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. No man knows God or his ways fully, and so in some sense, no matter how wise a man becomes, he will always be a fool. The one who has not learned these things, Agur tells us, is too stupid to be a man. Man was originally intended to be in perfect relationship with God, and it is as a result of our sin that we are not. For this reason, Agur tells us a man is worn out and weary with life. So summarizing the first three verses, we don't fully know God, we are unwise, and so we are weary. In verse 4, Agur describes God in a rhetorical question. He asks us, who established the earth? The answer to that obviously is Jehovah, our God. Agur poetically describes this one as having the wind in his fist and the water as a garment, representing God's total control over the forces of nature. In verse 4, Agur describes God in a rhetorical question. He asks us, who established the earth? The answer to that obviously is Jehovah, our God. Agur poetically describes this one as having the wind in his fist and the water as a garment, representing God's total control over the forces of nature. He also describes him as one who has ascended to heaven and come down. Interestingly, Agur does not only ask us what is his name, but also what is his son's name. The implication that God has a son, made here in the Old Testament about 900 years before Jesus was born, is interesting. It implies to us the doctrine of a triune God and an eternally existing pre-incarnate Christ. Throughout verses 4 through 6, God is contrasted to man. Where man was depicted as weary and foolish, God is here depicted as powerful. Verses 5 and 6 tell us that God is a shield to those weak humans who take refuge in him. God is not only powerful, but he is wise. All of his words prove true, and they are to remain unaltered. Any alteration from man could only be foolishness which would detract from God's already perfect wisdom. Having contrasted man and God in verses 7 through 9, Agur makes two requests of God. First, Agur asks that God would take falsehood away from him. That, of course, would be beneficial. The more truth Agur has, the more wisdom he has. The more wisdom he has, the better off he will be. Second, Agur asks God to give him neither poverty nor riches. Agur contends that poverty would compel him to profane God by stealing, but that being rich would tempt him to trust in himself and thus to deny God. Agur preferred to have a middle path. He asked God to give him just as much food as he needed. No more, no less. After that opening discourse, the rest of Agur's words are a series of epigrams interspersed with shorter proverbs. One of those proverbs is in verse 10. It reads, "Do not slander a servant to his master, lest he curse you and you be held guilty. Honesty is the best policy. Don't tell lies about people. That will get them into trouble." Our first epigram, contained in verses 11 through 14, describes for us the wicked, or at least, I presume, based on the context, that Agur's intent is to describe wicked people. He never actually says that the people described here are wicked, but based on our knowledge from the whole of Scripture, the descriptions speak for themselves. Agur gives three descriptors of the wicked, depending on how you slice them. First, he says that they curse their fathers and do not bless their mothers. Disrespect for parents would be a descriptor of an unwise or wicked person. Second, in verse 12, that they are clean in their own eyes, despite being unwashed. That, I think we are safe to say, is a metaphor for sin. There are many who live in sin and yet proclaim themselves to be not sinful. That, obviously, is a problem. The only thing worse than being a sinner is being a sinner and not knowing it. At least someone who knows he is a sinner is looking for a solution to the problem. But many people have too much pride to admit their sin. They lack the humility to consider their own wrong. Such people as that, we read in verse 13, communicate that they think they are better than other people by having their eyes and eyebrows lifted. They make an expression suggesting that they are better than others, but they aren't. Ultimately, we are all sinners. Third, in verse 14, are those who devour the poor and the needy. Such people as these are metaphorically described as having teeth like knives and swords. Obviously, as we have discussed elsewhere, it is not good to take advantage of the poor. We should help the poor rather than harming them or using their circumstances for our own benefit. In verse 15, we begin another epigram, which I think of as the first of Agur's five riddles. Now, whether or not we ought to think of these as riddles, I'm not sure, but I think of them as riddles because I find them confusing, and whether they are meant to be puzzling, their form certainly suggests a puzzle. For most of these, Agur opens with the same line, in which he says that there are three things that X and four things that Y. He then lists off four things which seem to fit both descriptions. Now, maybe the three things, four things set up is just a poetic way of saying, here are four things alike. In fact, such a form is found elsewhere in the Bible. Amos used similar words in Amos chapters 1 and 2 to describe the transgressions of the surrounding nations. But the opening sounds to me like a challenge. If there are three things like X and four things like Y, then that means one of the things on the list is in some way different than the others. All of them are like Y, but only three of them are like X. So one of the things is like Y, but not like X. In my mind, then, the riddle is figuring out which thing is not like X and how it is different from the others. It seems to me that perhaps there is some special wisdom to be gained in figuring that out. But then, if this is a game, I am losing because I don't know which thing is unlike the others. Let's take the first so-called riddle, for example. It opens by saying that the leech has two daughters, which are either named Give and Give or which cry out Give, Give, depending on which translation you choose. So we have a riddle about things that always demand more. There are three things that are never satisfied and four that never say enough. The four things that never say enough are first, Sheol, the grave and afterlife, which is always accepting new dead. Second, the barren womb, which I suppose represents to us a woman who is dissatisfied that she has no children. Perhaps she is always demanding of her husband, particularly, to produce a child. Third, the land that is never satisfied with water. That, I guess, is a desert land that soaks up whatever rain it gets and never has enough. And fourth, the fire, which just keeps burning so long as you keep throwing fuel into it. So all of those things never say enough, but which one would be the one that is satisfied? If I had to guess, I'd say the land, which at some point would actually become saturated with water if you just kept pouring enough water on it. The barren woman will never get enough to make her a child, Sheol will never get enough dead, and the fire will never stop burning so long as it has fuel. The trouble, of course, is that the passage says right there that the thirsty land is never satisfied, using the same word in Hebrew both here and in the four things that are never satisfied formula. The woman is unlike the others, though, in that she is human, and the others are just natural phenomena. But are we to take it that she is satisfied, but still won't say enough? That doesn't make much sense to me. I'm also not sure what we would learn if we did pick one of these as an answer. What really is the difference between something that is never satisfied and something that never says enough? What lesson could we draw there? No answer is readily apparent to me. So perhaps I take this poem too literally. Maybe three things X and four things Y is just a poetic way of saying four things. I think that what we are meant to do is to draw some lesson from what the things all have in common, and particularly we learn something about the human element and what they have in common. In trying to find a point here, I focus on the human element, that is, the barren woman. The point, then, I think, is that she is like a grave, a fire, or a thirsty land that never has enough. There is something precious to her that she wants and that she can't have, and so she will never be satisfied and will never have enough. In some sense, we are all like this. We all want things that we can't have. It is the general human condition to be dissatisfied. Whatever we have, there is always a little more that we don't have. And since we know we'd be happier if we had a little more, that's what we want, and we aren't happy until we get it. But then ask a man how much money he wants, and the answer is always one more dollar. Once you get what you want more. Perhaps the best way for us to be satisfied in life is to just not want so much. Paul said in 1 Timothy 6:8, "But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content." But then maybe this isn't all about the barren woman. I notice also a theme of destruction here. There is death in the world, there is destructive fire, there is dry land. Perhaps the first riddle also intends to point out to us that life on earth is inherently miserable. We live in a fallen condition. Life will be tough. In verse 17, we have another inserted proverb. In this one, Agur tells us that the eye of a person who mocks and scorns his parents will be plucked out and eaten by ravens. Now that obviously is metaphorical language not to be taken literally, but it intends that those who scorn their parents are bad and will receive bad. That aligns with what Agur said in verse 11, suggesting that those who disrespect their parents are wicked. And it also aligns with what we read about the family in Proverbs 10:29 and throughout the rest of the scriptures generally. The second riddle in verses 18 and 19 lists three things too wonderful for Agur and four that he does not understand. Agur does not understand how the eagle flies. This apparently means that he does not know the eagle's path once it has flown by. It leaves no trace in the air. He also does not understand how the serpent crawls across the rock. Again, the way of the serpent that it took is unknown, since it cannot be seen once the serpent is gone. Agur does not understand the way of a ship on the sea, since the waters close around its path, leaving no trace. And Agur does not know the way of a man with a virgin. Apparently, the intent here is that if a man seduces a virgin girl and neither of them talk about it, then there is no outwardly obvious evidence of the sin. The point to these verses, then, I think, is that sin is often easily hidden, just like the path of a snake on a rock. Our next inserted proverb at verse 20 seems to suggest that this is the intent of the previous riddle. This one describes the adulteress as eating, wiping her mouth, and saying, "I have done no wrong." Well, obviously, eating is not wrong. Clearly, the eating described here is a metaphor for a sexual act. The adulteress does a grave wrong by engaging in sexual activity with any man other than her husband, but she conceals the evidence and justifies her misbehavior. The adulteress would not commit adultery if she had not convinced herself that the action is not wrong and if she could not get away with it. So also, often, we callous ourselves and ignore our consciences and do that which we know deep down is bad behavior. We must not allow that. We must continually examine ourselves, and we must compare ourselves to the scriptures to know what is right and what is wrong. The third riddle, in verses 21 through 23, tells us three things that cause the earth to tremble and four whose weight it cannot bear. Now, it's hard to see how the earth could give way beneath something without trembling, so let's just take this as a list of earth-quaking things. First, when a slave becomes king. As we have noted, slaves at this time were usually criminals or other debtors. Debtors generally are those who either didn't work hard enough or who made bad investments. Slaves, then, are usually bad sorts of characters and not the best leaders. Lazy, unintelligent, or inept, criminal at worst, are descriptors. They would not make good kings, and having one of them on the throne would be a disaster, like an earthquake, for everyone else. Second, a fool full of food. Fools misbehave. Their actions generally bring on poverty, and that poverty teaches them to be less foolish. But sometimes people make it past the natural feedback loops. Sometimes fools manage to stay wealthy, having no meaningful consequences for their misconduct. They fill their bellies and use the energy that the food gives them to go right on engaging in harmful activities. Harmful like an earthquake. Third, an unloved woman when she gets a husband. Now that, on this list, seems to be a thing unlike the others. The other things on the list are all bad things. It seems like this is a good thing. A woman who was once unloved is now loved. She has a husband. The commentators that I checked through described this as a woman who struggled to find a husband, who became embittered because of that, and who then, once she finally gets a husband, becomes obnoxious to everyone else as a result. Ellicott's commentary says, quote, she pays off with interest the slights which she had formerly to endure from her married friends, end quote. Fourth on the list of earthquaking things is a maidservant who displaces her mistress. This could imply that the man of the house throws out his wife so that he can take the servant instead. That obviously would be a selfish and shameful activity which would cause great harm. A good wife deserves the love and support of her husband as she ages. She shouldn't be replaced. Alternately, this could describe a maidservant who is heir to her mistress's things. When the mistress dies, the maidservant suddenly becomes wealthy. As a consequence, the maid suddenly has the power without knowing how to handle it. She's like a fool with a full belly. The next epigram in verses 24 through 28 describes four small but clever things. It does not have the 3X and 4Y formulation. It's just a list of four things that are clever. Those things are, first, ants. Ants are small and weak, but they provide food for their colony. Ants are relatively strong compared to their size, but compared to a man, they are nothing. Ants can do some big things, though, with teamwork and diligence. If we want to be wise and effective like the ants, we also should work diligently, and we should work as a team. Second, rock badgers. They are furry little creatures that live among the rocks. They're about the size of a rabbit. They apparently are considered wise in that they are able to live in an environment of rocky cliffs which would be too hard for humans to live in, despite the fact that rock badgers are smaller and weaker than humans. I'm no expert on rock badgers, and I'm not sure what we might learn from them. Third, locusts. Locusts have no king, but they still hang together as a group, which makes them very effective at destroying things. As with the ant, teamwork is effective. Fourth, lizards. Lizards are ironically easy to catch, but they can still sneak into anywhere, even the king's palace. I don't think I could pull that off. But then I'm also not sure what we can learn from it. If I could climb walls, shrink and fit through tiny cracks, and change my color to camouflage myself, then I would probably be better at sneaking into places like king's palaces. So maybe those are things I need to learn to do. In the next epigram, in verses 29 through 31, we have a list of three things stately in their tread and four things stately in their stride. As for what difference there is between a thing stately in tread and a thing stately in stride, I see none. So four things here that walk stately. First, we have the lion. To this day, we, with little accuracy, still call the lion the king of the jungle. The lion is an apex predator, and so he doesn't back down from a fight. Second, from the ESV, a strutting rooster, though there is some question about the identity of this creature. The word in Hebrew is zerzir. It appears only here in the Bible, and apparently no one has any clear indication of what it actually is. So the ESV guessed rooster, but the KJV guessed greyhound. The word zerzir apparently describes something which is, according to Strong's, tightly girt, that is to say, clothed in such a way as to run quickly. Strong's also suggests perhaps that this is a cock, that is a rooster, or a raven. So if we're talking about just something that is fast, I suppose greyhound is not a bad guess, but then using only that criteria, any darting fish might be a good guess as well, and those have almost nothing in common with a greyhound. Gesenius suggested that the word might mean a war horse, and cited others as suggesting a zebra, or maybe a wrestler, which is a human and no animal at all. BlueLetterBible.org also suggests, without citing any source, that the word might describe an extinct animal. So this one is very difficult to define, to the point that there's really no telling what we're talking about here. I'm going to go with rooster in hopes that the people who translated the ESV know something that I don't. Third is a he-goat, that is, a buck. And whatever exactly the second one is, then, we have a pattern in these three. We have probably the male of some species, and there seems to be a pattern of having a competitive nature. The male lion runs out the other males to keep the females for himself, roosters are known to fight for the same, and bucks will headbutt and horn each other, etc. They're all sort of stereotypical tough guy creatures. They've got a proud look about them, the lion with his mane, the rooster with his colored plumage, and the goat with his goatee and horns, and they all walk around with a stately stride and a harem. They are to be compared to the fourth, a king with his army with him. What does this say about the king? It suggests to me that the king thinks too highly of himself. It seems to me that being compared to strutting animals is not a positive thing. However, maybe this is just a comparison. As the alpha male is tough among his species, so the king is tough among ours. Try not to get in his way. And in our final two verses, we have an exhortation against foolishly pressing anger. Continuing to push an issue out of anger causes strife, here compared to pressing milk to produce curds or pressing the nose to produce blood. Now, I'm no cheesemaker, but my understanding is that curds are not so much produced by pressing milk as they are separated from whey by pressing milk after it has already curdled. But set that aside. To push an issue in such a way is here connected with being foolish or exalting oneself or devising evil. And while such as those are not always the case, they could be. A person who is angry might be devising an evil scheme. He might be exalting himself and he might be foolish, but he isn't necessarily. However, if such is the case, the passage tells us that he should, metaphorically speaking, put his hand over his mouth. That is, stop talking, stop pressing the matter. It will cause strife to do otherwise. So I've taken these various words of Eger and summarized them into a list of 12 takeaway lessons. First, God is all-powerful and all-wise, but man is not. Second, having far too much wealth, or not nearly enough, could push a man to abandon God. We should seek to have our daily bread, but not much more than that. Third, we should not slander others. Fourth, we should honor our parents. Fifth, we should care for the poor and downtrodden. Sixth, we should not think too highly of ourselves, or think ourselves better than others. Seventh, life is often difficult and dissatisfying. Eighth, the evidence of sin is often concealed. Ninth, that we desire justice, such that the fool should not be filled and the slave should not be king. Tenth, that like ants and locusts, we should learn to work together. 11th, that it is hard to beat a man in power. And 12th, that it is unwise to angrily press a conflict. Much of that coincides with what we have seen of wisdom elsewhere, and with what we considered last week in the sayings of the wise. To conclude then, this week we have considered Proverbs 30, a peculiar little chapter that contemplates the wisdom of Eger. Eger is otherwise unknown, but much of what he said conforms with the rest of the Proverbs. Herein, he acknowledged the weakness of man in comparison to God, man's desperate need for wisdom, the errors of those who curse their parents, who think too highly of themselves, and who mistreat the poor. He also spoke against adultery. Amid these things, Eger gave us some puzzling epigrams, most of which follow a 3 things X and 4 things Y format. These epigrams are very much poetic, and their implication for wisdom is often mysterious. But within them, we learn that life is difficult, that a barren womb is a curse, that a slave ought not to be king, that a fool ought not to be filled, and a maid not ought to displace her mistress. We learn not to exalt ourselves and not to press our anger.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.